Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Chris McIntyre, who is a psychologist and he's an ex-police officer. So today we're going to have a chat about his experience as well as looking at mental health and how to proactively look after yourself, particularly going into this profession. So thanks for joining today, Chris. Do you mind introducing yourself a little bit?
Well, you kind of did a good job, but no, I'm ex-police. I worked in the Queensland Police Service for about 5 years on the Gold Coast. I was mainly stationed at Broadbeach Police Station. I did general duties and some intel work. I left the police so I could become a psychologist, which was a challenge because to leave all of the stuff that I knew behind and move into a completely different profession and start addressing mental health, which hasn't always been something that's been spoken about in the police or in terms of the mental health of staff, not so much the members of the public that we deal with, but in terms of the impacts it has on staff. And then to go and work in the veteran space, which I've been for the last 3.5 years working alongside veterans with PTSD. So I've had a bit of exposure both as a service person and then also now on the other side dealing with the outcomes of first responder work as well as military work as well. I think the unique thing about first responders, and this is a lot of what's come out of the research, is it's the ongoing exposure to trauma. That's the real difference between, say, someone that goes to war versus a paramedic that may, you know, I don't know, be in the job for 10 years and see far more things than one sees in a 3 month tour of Afghanistan. So not that diminishing the trauma that someone in Afghanistan experiences, but we know it's an accumulation effect within first responder community. We also know that when they commissioned the report in 2016, I think they found it was approximately 8% of the ADF present with symptoms consistent of PTSD, whereas within the first responder community, it was anywhere between 8 to 12%, so slightly higher, and higher again in paramedics, which is quite interesting.
Absolutely.
Because if you're a police officer, you may get exposed to, you know, ongoing traumas, but there are also days where you're handing out traffic tickets. It's a little bit different for your paramedics, that all they deal with is trauma day in, day out.
Absolutely. And so from that trauma perspective, how does it actually, the experiencing trauma impact you, and how does it change you, I guess?
Well, there's a number of different ways. So when we talk about the impacts of trauma, you know, we might reference childhood trauma, or we might look at, you know, something like a bank robbery or a car crash or things that we may be involved in that cause a trauma response. With, I guess, working as a paramedic, there are some aspects where you become kind of, I guess, desensitized to it because you go to it so often. So you might, like, let's say you're working near the M1, for example. Traffic crashes on the M1 are a common occurrence just because of the amount of traffic that is on the M1. Over time, you're, I guess, going to these so often that you become somewhat numb to them. And that may seem okay to begin with, but that can have, you know, lasting effects psychologically as well as interpersonally with our family and friends. I think the big thing is, though, the constant, and I know the paramedics are really focused on, you know, maintaining heart rate and things like that when they go to jobs, so they'll walk, they won't run, they're very conscious of that. But over time, seeing, I guess, that kind of image, you know, of a person deceased, particularly if, say, the individual connects with the person. So an example might be you go to a traffic crash and the person is a similar age or has similar life experience to you in some way, and you somewhat identify with the victim. That can also be traumatic. Anything that goes against our morals as well, or what we value in life, can be very traumatic. So, you know, working, maybe you're dealing with victims of, you know, childhood abuse or trauma or sexual abuse, and it's a really strong value set that you have, and then you're exposed to it over and over again, can change the way you see the world and how you see yourself. And there's also that idea that as a paramedic you want to save people, but that's not very possible all the time. You know, when you go into severe traumas like traffic crashes or suicides. So they're also that conflict with our morals and values as well. So it's not just experiencing something really intense like a bank robbery or a firefight if you're a police officer. It's also experiencing things that may impact how we see ourselves as well as how we see the world.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I recently came across the topic of post-traumatic growth. Have you done a lot of research into that? And I guess could you shed some light on that as well if you do?
In terms of personal growth afterwards, when I work with someone with PTSD, the first part of it is to stabilize. The second part, if we can, we want to process the traumas. And then thirdly, we want to challenge the beliefs we now have about ourselves and the world because of the trauma. So I would say that's more referencing to stage three of treatment that I do. It's a complex experience, though, because let's say you're a victim of childhood abuse, and one of the things that you experience is that you no longer trust people. Right? Fair call. You know, that is really hard to challenge cognitively in a person to make change. It may be that you're a police officer and you go to a really violent incident or a really traumatic incident, and you develop this fear or trust about the world and people and feeling safe. That takes a lot of time for us to challenge, change, and then also maintain. Because you might see with someone with PTSD, for example, we may make all of this growth and change, but lapse and relapse are quite common. So even after processing, it's not uncommon to see someone with PTSD go back to being in a really disordered state. So stage three for treatment is really important, but it's really hard to get there and then to maintain it.
For sure. And so trying to go for more of a proactive way to look after your mental well-being, what are some of the ways in which people, especially as students before going out on placement, start to develop these positive, ways of coping and things like that before going on placement? What can they do?
Well, I'm not sure what the QAS does in terms of their people management, but it'd be very important to connect with a peer that's maybe been in the job for some time that is obviously functioning well. But also I would be encouraging to have a really good rounded psychological set of strategies that they use daily to manage mental health before they even go into a job such as being a paramedic. So doing people, I think, become complacent about self-care. It's quite easy to become complacent about self-care because it's something that you have to invest in, you have to plan and do. But I guess with paramedics, the problem that paramedics face is shift work. Sometimes you don't get time to have meals, overtime, poor diet can creep in too because you're on shifts. So maybe meal planning goes out the door for a while, fatigue because of the overnight sleep. So there's a whole range of factors that aren't present in a day-to-day job like mine as a psychologist. So you have to actually be more vigilant with self-care. I would want to be aware of what my baseline functioning is so that I know when that starts to deteriorate. So if my baseline functioning is that, I operate by going to the gym daily, I eat healthy, I'm regularly socializing with friends, and I know what my baseline across all of that is so that I'm aware when that starts to change before it becomes an actual issue, a stress disorder or something else. So I don't encourage people to access psychologists for the sake of accessing psychologists. Like, I wouldn't encourage that, but I would encourage somebody to at least familiarize themselves with the impacts that ongoing exposure to trauma is going to have. So it's not saying you can escape. You can't turn around and say to the comms, or if you guys call it comms, we used to call it comms, oh, I'm not going to go to that job. Like, you can't say that. That's your job. You've chosen, you've signed up. So some people sign up and they're naive, like I was as a police officer. I was naive to what you actually do and what you see until I saw it. And then I was like, oh, I can't undo that now. I've seen it. So being aware that what trauma can do, so that you're not like going out and, you know, causing yourself anxiety and you're sitting on Google at night going, oh, PTSD, no, but just having a bit of a basic understanding of the potential that trauma could have on your life. Again, having a really good mentor or peer mentor. In psychology, we have supervisors. So, like, I have someone that's senior to me that I regularly check in with to manage my practice as well as mental health. That would be something I would encourage people to do. We did have a system like that in the police where we had peer support workers. I would encourage you to educate your family as well. So whoever, like partner, you know, mum or dad or whoever's supportive of you, I would encourage you to actually educate them about not the specifics. So you don't need to tell them the blood and guts of the stories, but the impact that trauma can have on a paramedic. There's plenty of information out there about impacts of trauma. But I think having those early conversations rather than what I get now is when partners come in and say, you know, Bob has changed completely. I'm just using Bob. Bob's not a real person. And now we're starting to find out the impacts of trauma, when we should have spoken about that in academy or when you're going through your degree with your partner or family or whoever's a support person, so that they are also watching for change. Because the way I treat PTSD is I consider it a family illness, because not just the individual's impacted, but by everyone in the family's impacted. So, like, if you've got a partner, kids, mum and dad, friends, they're all impacted by PTSD. So the individual has the issue, but everyone else experiences it and differently. So I think that pre-warning, so I would be, you know, if I took my time over in the police, I would have sat down with my partner and said, hey, I've gone and done some research about what I could or may be exposed to and potential impacts of that, and this is what it looks like. And then putting a bit of a plan together to manage my mental health, because it's easy to slip into poor habits with shift work, with stress. Like, even for myself as a psychologist, I'm not exposed to what some of the paramedics are exposed to, but I'm still exposed to things that can cause stress. And so I have a good plan about how I manage my stress. And my partner is aware of when I'm not managing it as well as I should. So then we put things in place. So I guess it's similar to what we call safety planning, but it would be more around, I guess, managing mental health on the job, because I think it would be naive to expect the QAS to do it for you.
Absolutely. And so you've mentioned a bit about PTSD, and I guess for our first year listeners or anyone that doesn't know what PTSD is, do you mind explaining what PTSD is and I guess some of those signs and symptoms that would suggest that someone is developing or has PTSD?
Yeah, so PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder is it's a stress disorder that's referred to in the DSM as well as the ICD. Clinically, the diagnosis generally occurs by a psychiatrist. Psychologists, clinical psychologists can make that diagnosis, but we would generally refer to a psychiatrist for that. Its prevalence, as I said, I think it's about 8% in the ADF and about 12% in the QAS, QPS, and then less so in the fireys, but it's still quite prevalent. It's characterized by a number of symptoms, but the key ones are generally characterized by like reoccurrence of events. So that may have happened. So like maybe reliving a car crash that you were involved in, flashbacks. So feeling as if you're back at the scene, memories. So unwanted memories, intrusive memories that may not be relevant to what you're doing right now. So like I might be at the movies and I start remembering something traumatic that happened in my life, not really relevant to the scene. Easily triggered. So like Channel 9 has a chopper in Brisbane that when it flies over, a lot of Vietnam vets hit the ground because it sounds like the same chopper that flew in it was one of the most significant days in Vietnam, but it reminds them of that day. I got other guys that would tell me that pork reminds them of the burning flesh at war. So when they go to barbecues, they can be triggered. What else? There's so many different things that can cause you to relive the memory. Then obviously insomnia, poor sleep, nightmares are really common with PTSD. Sleep apnea has also got a strong relationship with PTSD. A lot of guys that I work with have sleep apnea and insomnia. Then we get all the things like hyperarousal, hypervigilance, loud noises make a lot of my guys jump through the roof, hit the deck, get ready, like particularly if they're police or ex-military, they go straight to fight. Then you've got the dissociative type symptoms. So the idea that one's lights are on but no one's home, so time can go missing for people. You might see an increase in risk-taking behaviour, so like drug and alcohol use, engaging in severe cases of like self-harm and suicide type behaviour. And then we've got the cognitive side of things, so a change in the way they see themselves, a drop in, you know, self-esteem. We can see depression, anxiety. In severe cases, sometimes there are bipolar type symptoms present, so there might be hypomania or mania, but not often, and it's not always evident. More often than not, I see clients ending up with like major depression because of the symptoms they're experiencing. So it is a really complex disorder. It definitely requires psychiatric intervention. It can't just be treated through a psychologist, so you need a psychiatrist to oversee the medical and treatment side of things, and then a psychologist is there to do that stabilization, trauma processing, and then obviously looking at our cognitive beliefs and core beliefs about the world afterwards. But it is a complex disorder to treat. I think it's people understate the actual impact that it has on someone until they have it. Like I've had guys go to me, oh, I didn't believe in it, it was garbage, you know, I brushed off and now they've got it. And they realise how actually life-changing it is. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. That's one thing I would say. I think you, it's not an easy disorder to treat. And I see clients that were once at the top of their game, like really functioning well, now not even able to, you know, do self-care, like go and get a, you know, look after themselves, like do the hygiene stuff even. However, when you get good treatment and you get the right treatment and you get the good support, recovery is high. So, you know, like I speak to some psychiatrists and they say with good treatment, someone can recover within 2 years. So there's pros and cons to having that early intervention. Yes, obviously people don't want to be labelled with something like PTSD, but the earlier the intervention, the more effective treatment's going to be. And treatment doesn't just exist around the individual, but saving relationships as well. Because that's what I see a lot of, is the individual will come to me when the relationship has already ended. And they're trying to salvage something that no longer is salvageable. For sure. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. That's a really great insight into what it is and about it all. But I noticed that, you know, on your Instagram, I think you're Fit As Dad, it's your handle, and you look at fitness and like physical well-being as like a protective method for, you know, mental well-being. How does fitness play a role? And because you're very, very big on it. So love to hear insight on that.
I'm big on core strength. A reason I'm big on core strength is because it's the grounding of one. And we don't do a lot of grounding anymore because we don't spend the same amount of time in our natural environment as we used to. We all live in buildings. We're all in office spaces or in cars or whatever. So core for me is like, I guess the, so there's some evidence, and it's only in its early stages around using core, particularly with like trauma-informed yoga as a secondary treatment for PTSD as well. So it wouldn't be your primary treatment. Again, that goes back to the psychiatrist and psychologist, but it is a secondary treatment. And I encourage all my clients with PTSD to do something like trauma-informed yoga. So core strength for me, and if you watch my Instagram, a lot of it is just core challenges that I set myself or I get set. Because I feel like the stronger my core and base, the more grounded I am and more capable I am of dealing with stress on a day-to-day basis. We know strength training is really, really good for managing like depression and anxiety symptoms. Cardiovascular endurance or training is good for mental clarity, cognition. So the research is available. I guess the challenge around exercise is getting a good balance, but also being able to get someone with PTSD or similar to exercise.
Absolutely.
So that's the challenge. But with most of the training that I do, it's generally centered around how do I ground myself and give myself a really stable base so that I can cope with everything that life comes with. And so I try to teach my clients the same thing. I will send them to physios, to exercise physiologists, to get programs so that they can do core, like they don't have to hang off the side of a pole like me and do a flag. That's just me being silly. But it's more like, how do they build their core strength up? How do they work on feeling strong again? Because PTSD and other mental health conditions really impact somebody's self-worth and self-esteem.
For sure. And so that makes a lot of sense. And, yep, you know, definitely something to, keep in mind and start to do. So just to finish off, what are your key strategies, mm-hmm, or tips to, I guess, maintain someone's, you know, good mental well-being and, you know, maintain longevity in the job?
Yes, I've got four pillars. These are like my four. So first one is sleep. Yeah, effective sleep. So people come to me and tell me that, oh, I can't sleep. Sleep is a behavior. Like there's no way I was going to get good at a human flag unless I practiced it, right? Sleep is exactly the same thing. You have to practice it. Obviously, with insomnia or sleep apnea, then you might need a level of intervention, right? Just like if you've got a bad back, you need to see a physio to, you know, to manage that bad back. Now, insomnia or sleep apnea, if you get good management plans, you can still live with and deal with and get the best out of your sleep. So sleep for me is number one. It's a behavior. It needs regular practice. It needs attention. I spend a lot of time and effort on my own sleep because I know how valuable my sleep is to my functioning. Number two is exercise, which we just spoke about. But exercise means different things to different people. So you don't have to go and do like heavy lifting or run marathons. It could be yoga, Pilates, swimming, running, I don't know, Tai Chi, whatever you're into. But you have to do it regularly. Then we've got, I don't talk about dieting, but I talk about healthy eating. So, because I don't use the word diet, because a lot of my clients have associated diet with like negative kind of, it's got a negative connotation to it. It's thrown around in social media a lot. Go on this diet, you'll feel better. So I use more of that healthy eating. So it's more around, eating what you want to eat, but in a way that is safe, it's mindful. It's going to support your well-being. Then finally, I do the whole mindfulness grounding process. That's my fourth. So I'm talking about just being back out in nature, whatever that looks like. It could be that you want to be at the beach or the rainforest or walking in grass, whatever it is. So reconnecting with earth. They're my four pillars. Basic. That's what we do in first session.
That's really good.
And then I repeat myself over and over again.
No, I really like that. That's popped up quite a lot, sleep, nutrition, looking after yourself, just all of that. So that's really good. Well, I do thank you for your time. I know you're busy and you've got lots of things going on. So thank you so much for coming on. Is there any way that our listeners can find out a bit more about you?
Well, they could jump on Instagram. All my stuff's on Instagram, really. So Fit As Dad is the best way to probably connect. I do respond to messages, like appropriate messages. Sometimes people send, like, I'm sure they're not your listeners, but people send strange messages and I won't respond. But like mental health messages, I always respond to. And if I can't help, I've got that many referrals and people I know that I can send people to. So probably Fit As Dad would be the best way.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time out of your day.
Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.